Welcome back to the Mel Kay Show. My guest today is one of the people that started me down this road of wanting to expose truth and look at what was going on in not just America, but the world. His book, Clinton Cash, changed my perspective on what was going on in our country. And he has not stopped since. He is the one oversight person we can always count on to get to the truth. His new book, Blood Money, is a must read for everyone, not just in America, but probably the world. Thank you for joining me, Peter Schweitzer.
Mel, great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, sir. I am deep into this book. A lot of it is shocking and eye-opening. But first and foremost, why did you choose this as your book right now? Because you tend to pick your topic on what you think we the people need to know. And that is really what I first and foremost want to know.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things that have been happening in the country over the last 5 years that just seem not to resemble the country that I'm familiar with. I'm 59 years old. A lot of social tumult, a lot of chaos, a lot of people dying from fentanyl overdoses. And I just kind of wondered, you know, is there a thread here? Is there a common thread here? And basically what I discovered with the research, it's basically took a year and a half. I have 13 researchers that worked on it, is that, you know, America's on fire. China's holding an empty can of gasoline and our leaders are sitting there quietly and not saying anything about it. That's kind of the mental picture that emerged from the research. And I just felt the need for people to understand fully what's going on. A lot of these actions that are happening are connected in some way and part of, I would argue, a broader agenda by the CCP and others.
Yeah, you know, that's where people tend to put everyone into different pockets. So the CCP's here, Russia's here, the US is here, and that's not really where we are anymore. I call it the parent company running planet Earth, because there is a supra group that are, you know, much different than what people believe. One thing that I do look at a lot is a lot of people don't realize that the CCP is at the top of many of the agencies in the United Nations. And also when people talk about the World Economic Forum and point at Klaus Schwab and say, you know, that's the dangerous guy, they don't realize that the CCP is at the top there too, and at the World Health Organization, and in Agenda 2030. So I wanted you to kind of connect that, because people seem to think these are all different groups, and actually I think they're all working in concert with the CCP, kind of as their top VIP.
Yeah, I mean, they have common goals, and they have common worldviews. It's not to say that necessarily Klaus Schwab is going to be exactly like the CCP, but he has the same view of the relationship between the government and the governed. And that is that an expert class of elite people should be running things, which is essentially where the CCP is. I mean, this is a communist party, of course, but it's very different than the communist party of the Soviet Union and Cuba. It's really run by technocrats. And the technocrats have the view that, you know, people are going to make poor decisions, so we're going to guide them, and we're going to use the force of government to guide them. Klaus Schwab's not going to say it in exactly the same way, but if you look at what the World Economic Forum talks about and advocates for, right, and how they want it implemented, you see it's kind of like a Venn diagram. You know, the circles come together, and you see the absolute overlap. And you're quite right. You look at these international institutions like the World Health Organization, which is dominated by the CCP, even though that the senior health officials in China are not just scientists, they're also senior officials within the Communist Party, and they run Communist Party cells in their labs. So, yeah, there's a lot of commonality. People like to throw around the idea and say, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. It's not a conspiracy. It's individuals that have a common worldview and interest that are working cooperatively together. It doesn't mean they're doing everything together, but they're doing a lot of stuff together, and they are achieving results together. And the World Economic Forum, which is ostensibly supposed to be capitalist, does a lot of cheerleading for a communist country in China and upholds it as a model for other people to imitate.
Exactly. I did a whole thing on the last Davos conference, and they were treating the CCP delegates like they were the VIPs of Davos. And they even came out in one of their panels. Somebody was talking about how well the CCP controlled their resources, and they were essentially talking about people. And I'm sitting there saying, how do people not understand what they're saying here? They're saying that they want this globalist kind of global governance model, but they want the CCP's model of how they run their people. And that is a scary thing. Now, I also wanted to talk about, it seems like after your book came out, everyone obviously that has any kind of idea of what is going on and would like actual oversight, unfortunately, you have to do the oversight, and places like Judicial Watch, and we the people think the government should be doing that, and they're not. So you kind of are that in place of what we would like the government to be. But immediately upon that, they started talking again about TikTok. They started talking again about looking into the relationship between some of the military industrial complex and China. And one thing I did want to go back to in this talk is there was once a big situation in China with Google China. And when they set up their social credit score, and now we know that it is fully surveilled, there is nowhere in China that is not surveilled, that people aren't on their ledger blockchain, aren't use social credit score, all of that. And the people that helped implement that, the Google China people, they left at some point. But Eric Schmidt was still there. And now Eric Schmidt is in America behind the scenes at the Biden White House, writing the Declaration and the Bill of Rights for AI and doing all this stuff when he was intricately involved in the social credit track and trace surveillance in China. How dangerous is that and where we're going and who is actually behind the scenes in the science and technology of this current government apparatus?
Yeah, no, I think Eric Schmidt is an example of precisely the problems we're talking about. I did a documentary film in 2018 called The Creepy Line, which is available on Amazon. But the title was inspired by a statement by Eric Schmidt, who is asked, what are sort of the ethical constraints on what you do at Google? Because he was the CEO of Google at the time. And his answer was, well, we all know there's a line to cross. Right? There's a line you just don't cross. He said, we like to go right up to the creepy line, but not cross it. Now, a normal person, I would think like you or me, would be like, I don't even want to be near the creepy line. But his mindset was, I want to get right up to it as close as I possibly can. And that is, again, flows from this notion that top-down governance, which is what the CCP has, dictatorship, in other words, they admire it because it's efficient. They admire it because they get things done. These are the phrases that they use. Elon Musk has said this, because you can just get factories built so much more quickly there. The government will respond and take care of things. And of course, they can afford to do that because there aren't things like property rights and civil rights and judicial review, et cetera. So to have somebody like Eric Schmidt trying to call the shots on AI, trying to set up where that creepy line is going to be, we already know he wants to go right up to it. And guess what? He might be wrong. He might cross that line, or where he puts that line might be very different where the rest of us put that line. So I think on this particular issue, AI and the threat from AI, I'm much more in line with where Elon Musk is than where Eric Schmidt is. But again, this conversation, this discussion at the highest levels of government should be out in the open. Right. So people know what Eric Schmidt and these guys are suggesting that our government policy should be. Anytime they want to hide it, I get suspicious. And I think history proves that we're right to be suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, also, you know, it was their own workers in Google China that wanted to shut it down because it was offending them, you know, and that wasn't something that Eric Schmidt wanted to do. And then I believe that one of the women that worked there ended up coming here from China and working behind the scenes, Fifi Li of Twitter, during the time when everyone was purged. So you look at some of these things and you think, look, there's evidence that this is not going in the right direction. Now, another thing that I've covered a lot on my show is the Belt and Road Initiative. It appears that when Project for a New American Century paved their way for the 2000 forward plans for the world, they decided to go military, where the Chinese decided to go infrastructure and building ports and railways and mines and refineries all over the world, all over Africa, all over South America, the islands, everywhere. And at this point, 130 nations are involved in the Belt and Road Initiative. And it appears that the American or our government or whoever is running the public-private partnership that runs our government did not counter this at all. And now we're at a place where we kind of have to look at, okay, so all they've expanded, because I look at the Belt and Road Initiative, a lot of people look at it as them, you know, controlling these places in kind of the way the IMF. I look at it as that's probably also their military plan, you know, to control that. So what, where are we with the Belt and Road Initiative? We didn't compete with it. We didn't go and do all the same things as we could have with a lot of the money we've spent on militarizing the world. And then exported our values, because that's what they're exporting. So what, where are we in the Belt and Road Initiative? And is there a way to either counter it or to guard against, you know, it really becoming a military situation that is a real problem if it's not already?
No, I think it's a great question. And I think the Belt and Road has not been as successful as Beijing wants it to be, but it's still been very successful. And what it really is, I think, ultimately is a resource play. You're quite right. I mean, we thought about our relationships overseas in the geopolitical context, right? Is this a strategic waterway? Is this an area that'd be a good place to have an airbase? China viewed it as, there's going to be this great resource race that's taking place. Who's going to have access to lithium and these other critical minerals that are so important to so many future technologies, whether it's computer chips or alternative forms of energy? And we're going to target countries that have those minerals, and we're going to become their best friends. Right. And that's what they've done. And what's happened, particularly with the Biden administration, is we played right into that, because our alternative energy plan is putting us even more dependent upon China to meet those needs, whether it's wind turbines, whether it's solar panels, whether it's EV batteries. My view is, yes, let's look at alternatives. Let's figure out ways to encourage them. But we're moving from the old days in the 1970s when we were worried about OPEC controlling oil. The new OPEC is China.
Yeah,
because all of these alternative technologies, they control 80 to 90% of the production, and they increasingly control these minerals around the world. And what did we see during COVID? We saw during COVID that when people raised the prospect, governments raised the prospect in Australia or in the United States and said, we believe that this was a lab leak. We don't believe this was naturally occurring. What did the Chinese say? Well, we may shut shipments off for you. Right. We may stop shipping penicillin to you. So they've demonstrated that they're going to use these things to bully us and manipulate us. So while we have this great military capability, which I think is great and appreciate everybody serving in our country, China's kind of done an end around and said, well, it's great you have that military machine, but we are going to control the key components that drive your advanced economy.
Yeah, it's just so obvious that we really need to assess all of this. Everyone should have to have your book and start to really look at ways to counter this, or at least get in the way of it. Because at some point, we have a situation now where there are drugs that are back ordered for months that people really need, that have different heart problems or health problems, that they can't get ingredients right now. And we don't know if that's on purpose or not, but it could be. And it's very dangerous. Now, I was recently in Oklahoma, and I did not know about what was going on in rural Oklahoma. We were driving, and we stopped and met a couple people that own a big farm outside of Tulsa. And they told us that there were Chinese gangs that had bought all this farmland and were farming marijuana all over Oklahoma, and that they were showing up, like, he was a contractor too. So he would go to like Home Depot, and these Chinese men would show up with, like, to pay for the stuff in boxes of cash, and that this was becoming a real problem. And that, you know, for the first time in, you know, these are farmers for decades that have had this land. They felt a little scared where they were, because they don't speak English, and there's a lot of them, and they don't really know where they stay. They just know the farmland that they're on. So what is actually going on? Because a lot of people talked about China buying a lot of our farmland, but I think people thought they bought our farmland to farm here for us, which is not true.
Yeah, no, it's a huge problem. It's part of what in China they call cognitive warfare. which is they really want to try to encourage the dumbing down of America. And one of the ways that they do that is by this massive number of illegal marijuana grows around the country. And what they're growing is not the kind of pot that's legalized, not the kind of pot people smoked in college in the 1990s. This is highly potent marijuana, and they have set up shop all the way across the country. I write about this in Blood Money extensively. And here's the thing people need to know. When you see those pictures of Chinese nationals coming across the border in Mexico, some of those are probably coming for a better life, but some of those are also going to work for these illegal marijuana grows, because in the cases that have been exposed, overwhelmingly, these are marijuana grows that are financed from China, and they are being run by Chinese nationals who are illegally in the United States. And to show you how extensive this is, in the state of Maine alone, you know, beautiful Maine that I've been to, which, you know, doesn't have a huge population. In the state of Maine alone, there are 300 known illegal marijuana grows involving Chinese nationals who are illegally in the country. 300 alone. They have them in California. The sheriff of San Bernardino County says they're busting them all the time. He says 95% of them are run by illegal Chinese nationals in the United States. They're finding them in Oklahoma. They're finding them in Washington State. So it's a massive, massive problem. It makes the money, and it also serves a larger geopolitical purpose. It promotes this marijuana that causes, frankly, cognitive damage.
Yeah.
And debilitates people's ability to operate and function in a normal way.
Yeah, and you know, you look back to the opium wars back in the day, you know, when it was on them. So, you know, these people are very strategic, and people forget that the Chinese have a very long history. We're a very young country. Yeah. They are not. And there's a big difference when it's that invested, but it's something that we've seen before. Now, we're also, you brought up, I lived in Hollywood for 20 years. So I saw in the early 2000s, something happened there. First of all, the big agencies, which have a lot more power than people realize, consolidated. One agency ate another giant agency, then this one and that one. So then they were consolidated. And my friends that were working either at the agencies or at studios were starting to tell me that they were getting funding from the Chinese Communist Party. They wouldn't say that, but it was one Chinese company after another. And you knew that they were owned by the Chinese. This is early 2000. And then what started happening is what we've seen happen in DEI hiring across the board started happening in Hollywood. And then at some point, it was like, if you wanted to make a movie at all, you had to kind of pass some kind of hurdles that a lot of people on the in the inside were saying, this is influence from China. And then also the SKG, which is DreamWorks, that would be Geffen, Katzenberg, and Spielberg, started kind of normalizing it, in my opinion, early on. And as most people know, Katzenberg is the co-chair of the Joe Biden re-election campaign. But what the infiltration in Hollywood seems to have been fully realized way beyond what it was then. So what is the story there? And some people say that China basically came, took all the technology, built a bunch of studios, copied a lot of Marvel's technology that they had and Lucas had that was very proprietary, took it back to China, built studios there, and are divesting from Hollywood. So where is that right now?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what they've done, is they captured a lot of the technological capability, but they've also been able to inject their themes and ideas into American movies. And it's pretty blatant when you look at it. And you know, you mentioned SKG is a perfect example of that. They made a deal. The Chinese came in and bought part of Amblin Entertainment, which is, you know, of course, a different company, but the same cast of characters.
Right.
And they also started co-financing films, not just with Katzenberg, but with others. I mean, all the major studios had these co-finance deals. And what they basically said was, look, if we're going to co-finance this, we need to have a say in what is in the script.
Right.
And it's not just about keeping Taiwan out or not mentioning the Uyghurs. It's actually the broader themes and ideas and the values that are presented. So one of the most blatant is you look at the Kung Fu Panda movies. The first two were done completely with American investors. They're great stories. They're about, you know, the panda trying to, you know, overcome his fears and his insecurities and have confidence in himself. Kung Fu Panda 3 was co-financed by the Chinese. They got to write part of the script. And it's a totally different message. It's about fitting in with the collective. There's even like a people's war that takes place where they kind of rise up against the authorities. And then you look at other films that have been, you know, co-financed. There was the Matt Damon movie, The Martian, which was co-financed with the Chinese. How does he get rescued? He's stranded on Mars. How does he get rescued? He gets rescued because NASA borrows technology from the Chinese.
Right.
That's how they end up rescuing the guy. That's in the movie because the Chinese wanted it in the movie and Hollywood was prepared to do it. So it's a massive problem. I'm kind of, you know, frankly, not surprised and frankly, a little happy that these Hollywood guys got ripped off because
they did. Yeah, China's people have to understand that.
Yeah, the Chinese have done this to so many other industries. How did they think they were going to be smarter and avoid this fate? And now they're in a situation where China's saying, we're going to make our own movies.
Right.
We don't have to worry about you anymore.
Exactly. And I know even people that I know in real life, you know, they can't really raise too much money anymore in Hollywood. So that's shut down. And a lot of people might not have realized that all because you thought the front company was a company that's been around for 20 years. It's also very strange. Right before this happened in Hollywood, there was a big situation. I worked for a company in the late 90s that did foreign film financing where they financed through Germany or through Poland or wherever before the movie was even made. To kind of have the seed money to get it up and running. And that became like illegal. Like they weren't allowed to do that anymore. And then at that same exact time was when the Chinese money came in. And I look back and that couldn't have been a coincidence. It's no different. And yet that was actually allies of ours. And this was something else. And the other thing is also the portrayal, especially of white men in movies and TV cannot be understated because the money was also in the giant agencies, which package content. And that's another thing. But you are right. A lot of people are having a hard time. And, you know, a couple directors have had to go. People don't know this probably have gone over there because the deal was you have to shoot it in China. And then when they get to China, they have CCP people all over watching them. You know, they know that they're being spied on, looking what they're saying. I know of two different productions, big multi, probably $100 million. One of them that shut down because when they were shooting in China, it was so disturbing to everyone on the set that they felt like that they were kind of in danger. And they just said they put the movie on hold.
Well, I'm glad they did it. I'm not surprised. And then you have people like the Russo brothers, you know, who of course did Captain America and they've had these other hits. They actually went over to China. China created a production company for them and they actually helped the Chinese government produce this movie called Wolf Warrior, which is it's a massive propaganda. People try to compare it to Rambo. It's totally different. I mean, one of the great things about Rambo is he's not only fighting the communists, he's fighting bureaucrats in his own government, right? I mean, it shows the incompetence and the corruption of his government. Why the Wolf Warrior movie is not that at all. It's the CCP is great. They're wonderful. They're terrific.
Right.
And the Russo brothers provided massive production support to make that an even more successful movie. And of course, the film was shown at embassies, Chinese embassies around the world as a propaganda vehicle. So, you know, these guys, unfortunately, in Hollywood are prepared to do a lot of things for a buck.
Yeah.
It's to the benefit of China and to the detriment of us.
Yeah. And what's very strange is a lot of the movies that they finance, also the enemy in those movies is Russia, you know, which is really, really strange the way that they manipulate everything.
Right.
Now, beyond that, I also wanted to bring up something that bothers me. I speak about what I call the international banking cartel and the parent company, that private public partnership that seems to have captured our government. One of the players in that is BlackRock. And most people are aware that for whatever reason, BlackRock seems to have some kind of relationship with the Chinese Communist Party where they are allowed to function in China basically as the only company that's financial services company that's not controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And what is scary about that also is that Larry Fink is also on the board of the World Economic Forum, behind the ESG score, a big proponent of the Great Reset, Fourth Industrial Revolution, and owns most of our, or at least controls most of our Fortune 500 companies. So what is the strange relationship between BlackRock and China?
It's a mutually beneficial, mutually reinforcing relationship. And you're exactly right. China has always used the access to our 1.2 billion people as the enticement for these corporate executives. BlackRock is over there. Blackstone is over there. But BlackRock is really the big one. And it really opened up because Larry Fink, I'll just be honest about it, pimped for the Chinese. He gave an interview in 2011, and he's given others, where he said, look, capital loves to invest in, his words, totalitarian countries, because you know who you're dealing with, things get done efficiently, and you don't have to worry about the chaos and confusion that happens in other countries, namely in democracies. So that was Larry Fink's equation. And what the Chinese said was, we will get with Larry Fink an advocate for our policies if we let him to come in and make money and if we control him. And so that was basically the bargain. So keep in mind, BlackRock makes a huge amount of money in China. What does China get in return? They get from Larry Fink and also from Steve Schwarzman at Blackstone, advocates for China, that the situation there is not quite so bad. So, Larry Fink has said, look, the human rights situation in China is overstated. It's not as bad as people think it is. When President Trump imposed tariffs on China when he was president, whether one agrees with that policy or not, what did China do? China didn't go to the White House and lobby. They went to Wall Street and they went to Larry Fink and said, do something about this. We don't want these tariffs on our products. And if you don't fix this, it's going to hurt you in China. So Larry Fink and other people on Wall Street went to Washington. It has turned the Wall Street crowd that is invested into China, the most effective lobbyists for the Chinese government in the United States. It is unfortunately a bargain with the devil that has ended up paying off for BlackRock, but it's to our detriment. So we don't even know when it's directly China meddling into our policies, because they have proxies who are willing to do it on their behalf.
Yeah, it's really disturbing. I mean, that whole situation, I remember I talk a lot about this speech that I played on my show or read on my show with Larry Fink talking about going direct to the people. It was in Wyoming, I guess, right before the 6 months, maybe before the COVID. And he was talking about basically the banks and the multinational corporations that consider themselves stakeholders going direct to the people. And I'm reading this saying, oh, they're talking about skipping the Constitution, the Bill of Rights and the government and using the corporations and the banks to control our behavior openly. And that's when I thought, oh, so this sounds just like communist China.
Yeah, well, and Mel, too. I mean, you know, he gives these wonderful speeches about environmental standards, governance and social ESG. He's not doing any of that in China. He's not going to the Chinese government and saying there needs to be greater freedom for people in China, that companies that are invested in China need to expect certain behaviors from the government. It's all on one side. It's all advancing the ESG agenda on one side. He's not pressing China on the situation there, which is far worse than it would be in any of these areas in the Western world. So it's, I think the ESG is another example of kind of being manipulated by China. China pushes this stuff overseas, but certainly doesn't practice it at home.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where the next layer of this insanity goes to, is the idea that China is, because, you know, first of all, Russia and China both are involved in Agenda 2030. So a lot of people think that they're not involved in the sustainable development goals, and that's these globalist oligarchs, and that no, they're from all countries. There's Muslim Brotherhood people involved, there's Chinese, Indian, Russian, American. It's like you said, it's a supra group that believe, like it's like Hunger Games over there. But the point of that whole thing is that China's not doing anything for the environment that is aligning with their goals of Agenda 2030, though they talk about it and they show up and they go to all the COP conferences and the 30 by 30 conferences. So China's just speaking, but is that also related to BlackRock and all of this as well? Because it's like they're pretending that they're doing it and they're not. So only we are?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, China builds more coal plants right. every year than in the entire country of Australia. And Australia has a lot of coal plants. And they're going to continue to do this for this foreseeable future. And this stuff has been in the past financed by Western investors. So the same Western investors that are advocating on behalf of the issue of climate change and saying we've got to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels, some of them are actually financing the construction of coal plants in China.
Yeah.
And yet they tell us the renewable is better, it's cheaper, it's safer, but that's not happening in China. So you're quite right. It's hard through the actual actions of what's happening in China to not see this as a cudgel that is being used against us to restrain us. Basically, the agreement in Paris, that was struck under the Obama administration, says China can basically build as many fossil fuel plants as they want until 2030.
Right.
And then they need to cap it. So what that does, Mel, is it incentivizes them to build like crazy until 2030. It's just stupid.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to imagine that that there is a controlled demolition of America being facilitated from within because a lot of these multinational public-private partners and stakeholders aligned with the World Economic Forum UN plan seem to be looking at their business model being not in America anymore. And really, there's a lot more people where they're developing the Belt and Road Initiative and also in China and India that seem to have taken, higher standards to the people that are looking at the bottom line financially. And, a lot of people still think that these companies like Disney and Nike and Apple are American companies. And I constantly have to say, no, they're not American companies. They're global companies and they are aligned with this global stakeholder capitalism. So where does that leave DC? Like where I go with that is the next thing. If Washington DC was not so captured and corrupt to the core, it appears, this could be stopped, or at least it could be fended off. But it doesn't appear that anyone with a position of power in Washington, D.C. through the SEC or Treasury or anywhere else is doing anything to protect the American people, our prosperity, our future, and all of this from everything that's going on. And is that because they are blackmailed, captured, they're in on it? What is the story with that? We are right now in $34 trillion worth of debt. We have geopolitical chaos everywhere. The central bank digital currency is looming. The BRICS nations have expanded beyond Saudi Arabia and continue to expand. And all I know is that many experts keep telling me that gold and silver is the best way to hedge against inflation and to protect your savings going forward. Did you know you can convert your 401k and IRA into physical gold and silver today? It can be shipped direct to your door or stored in a secure location. So go to our partners page at themelkayshow.com, fill out the form, and someone from Beverly Hills Precious Metals will get in touch with you right away to help you figure out the best course for you and your family ahead. Stay secure, stay safe, and prepare now.
Yeah, I think there's a combination of motivations here, but you're quite right. When you look at corporate America, at least a lot of them, they don't view themselves as American companies. There's a famous shareholder, a telephone call with the head of Nike, the CEO of Nike, saying, "Oh yeah, Nike's an American company, but it's also a Chinese company."
Right.
So they want to kind of straddle that. My view is, it's kind of like being in a family. If you want the benefits of being in the family, then you also have some of the responsibilities or burdens of being in the family. And my view is if they don't view themselves as an American company, if they have executives that are trapped in the developing world somewhere, don't come calling and asking the US military to come and get you out because you told us you're not an American company. Don't expect the benefits, the extension of the American system of law, which is so responsible for, you know, financial and economic prosperity around the world. Don't expect that to be there for you if you're not going to be there for it. And I think what you see in DC is a number of things. One, you see kind of the clout of political donations. Right. These companies use that leverage to try to get politicians to move in a direction. They also use lobbying, not just hiring lobbyists, but they will oftentimes hire the children of elected officials right. to be lobbyists for them. I saw a study a couple of years ago that I think one out of three U.S. senators, a third of them, had either an adult child or a spouse that was a registered lobbyist. Wow. So there's self-enrichment that's going on here. And then it's also what you see among our governing class, a less sense of patriotism and nationalism. They view the United States as one country among a cluster of countries. Right. Rather than as an independent country. Now, look, I'm a big believer. You have allies, you have treaties, you stand up for your friends, you want them to stand up for you. But at the end of the day, how you identify yourself and view yourself tells so much about the decisions you're going to make and whether you're going to make them for the benefit of your country and for your fellow citizens, or you're going to make it more broadly in a way that kind of obscures who you're actually doing it for. And that's the problem. It's a mindset problem too.
Yeah. In their own documents, I read a lot of their white papers. I'm sure you do too, because that's what you do. But a lot of talk is about that all these problems are global and basically the idea of nation states no longer works. And this goes all the way back to Kissinger and Brzezinski and Rockefeller and all of them and the people that invited China into the mix as well. But we are at a place where the American people really have to be very honest with themselves individually, if not in the whole, what we want for this country going forward. Because I do believe, you know, I keep saying to people, I don't think that this election upcoming is about left and right, Republican, Democrat, or Trump or Biden. I really think it's about ideology and what you want for the future of this country. Both men are flawed, you know, both men are divisive, but that's where we are. And we have these two parties and that's where we are, even if they look like one party, and we can all kind of agree that that is what is happening there because of what you just said. But, you know, I think people have to understand that there is a ideological difference between where we're headed and who these people are aligned with. So when you're looking at, because there is a lot of speculation, I know that John Ratcliffe put out a whole document before Trump even left office about the 2020 election and China being involved in that. Of course, nothing, I don't know how you've lived with this over 20 years of watching the corruption and nobody ever being held accountable. I still hold out hope for the Clintons, but on another show, we can talk about that. But going forward, I think it's really important that people understand from you that there is an ideological difference in this upcoming election that is really about the people deciding what they want for the future of this country.
Yeah, and I think it begins with a really basic question, and that is, do you view the United States, the system of governance, the history and the tradition that we have, do you view us as a citizen as a unique country? And what do I mean by that? Well, I think the evidence is kind of overwhelming. When you look at the individual freedom, the prosperity, the ability to speak freely, the ability to have property rights is unique, even by European standards. My parents are both from Europe. I lived in Europe. I went to graduate school in Europe. But the United States is unique and different. And if you don't begin with that assumption, if you sort of say, well, we're just like any other country, that I think is really the telling sign. And my fear is, at a very foundational level, we're losing that. And I don't know what the solution is. I don't know if it's, sending young kids to spend a year overseas to realize how things are different. It's not to say that things are bad in other countries. It's just we are unique and different, and we need to preserve that. Because if we start acting like we are any other country and we start saying, let's sort of radically change the way we view ourselves, our sense of identity, our sense of governance, we are going to be a far different country and a far worse country. Life will change pretty dramatically. And once it changes, it's going to be very, very hard to get it back. So I agree with you. There's this huge philosophical split. Yeah. I think it begins with this very foundational, fundamental question. And I would go so far as to say that people think we are just like any other country are either operating out of malice or ignorance, because the evidence to me is overwhelming that we are a very special, unique place in human history. And the stakes are very high going forward in losing that.
I agree with that. And you know, we have to also understand the infiltration into academia and the Marxist infiltration. What's scary is when you trace it back, I've done shows on the Weather Underground and kind of their influence, also Saul Alinsky and some of the other things that happened during that period of time that really influenced the Ivy Leagues, which were, you know, have really been a big light has been shown on the idea that these people are superior. They are the leaders of the future as they've come out as more and more overtly, you know, Marxists and communists and socialists and on the highest levels. And then all the people that have been injected into the government, especially during the Obama years from these institutions, Obama coming from Bill Ayers and Bernadine Norton's kitchen, basically. So we are at a place where academia has been fully infiltrated. And it's hard to say where the alignment is, but how much of that is money from China and China's influence? Because is there a difference between the Marxist socialist communist movement that we are seeing all over the United States, because it is happening. People might not know that they're doing it through, they have conferences, they don't have leaders, so you really can't see them. But if you see that there's a conference celebrating Angela Davis, where Bill Ayers is the main speaker and talking about abolishing private property, that's happening all over the country. And I don't know if China's involved in that. Are they different? And that is the biggest, that is also very, very big on college campuses and growing, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence of China's involvement with the American political left. I talk about that in Blood Money. Part of it is in academe. Part of it is sort of these radical groups in the streets that are, you know, pushing violence and disruptive behavior. It happened during 2020 with BLM. Right. The Chinese actually did an assessment and said that BLM is not really run by BLM. It's run by another group called FRSO, Freedom Road Socialist Organization, which is pro-CCP and aligned with them. If you look at a lot of the pro-Hamas disruptive protests that are taking place now, it's actually, people will say these are Palestinian protesters, and some of the protesters may be, but the people actually organizing them are FRSO and another pro-China group called PSL. And these are radical left-wing groups that are adding fuel to the fire. I think the other thing more broadly you can look at is how the left has changed really pretty dramatically, I would say, over the last 5 to 10 years. I went to college in the 80s. I remember there were Marxists. Yeah. They tended to be people that would read, Marx and Engels, Das Kapital, and you know, wax philosophical about the coming revolution. And I'm not saying they were harmless. I'm not saying that, but they were much less aggressive and agitated than the new left is. And the new left, I think, is deeply inspired by Maoism. Yes. You know, they use the shaming, they use the calling people out, they use the sort of dehumanizing, you're not entitled to speak, you're not entitled to have an opinion. That's what a lot of wokeness is. That comes straight, not out of Karl Marx, not even out of Lenin, that comes straight out of Maoism. And I think that China has a role there as well.
Yeah, it must. And what is scary too is that I don't think, you know, you look back to that Bezmenov interview with G. Edward Griffin that I've played and I looked at so many times, and you wonder, when did it become, you know, the Chinese? Because we were all looking at the Russians and Bezmenov's warning us and telling us their whole playbook, the exact same playbook, has been played by the Chinese. Have they been playing it together? What is the real relationship between China and Russia and in terms of this communist Marxist underbelly that is really tearing apart not just our country, many other countries as well.
Yeah, I think China and Russia have for a long time, let's say, have had a very difficult marriage. You know, there are times when they were feuding, where they were actual enemies, particularly in the 1960s, to see who is going to lead the communist world. But if you look at where the situation is today, there's clear cooperation. And I think a lot of times people mischaracterize Vladimir Putin. He has a lot of the trappings of kind of a Russian nationalist, and he is a nationalist, but he is still, in my mind, a Leninist. And has very, very strong views about how government should operate, and his views of the West led by America is very similar to China's view. And they've kind of buried the hatchet from a lot of the previous feuds, and they've recognized they need each other. China wants Russia because Russia is a counterforce to the West. Militarily and politically. And Russia, while they have these military capabilities, while they have a nuclear arsenal, their economy struggles. And so what happens is, Russia gets isolated because of the war in Ukraine. Well, China says, we'll sell your oil to us. It'll be a win-win for both of us. And, you know, Russia has minerals. China's interested in minerals. They find a way to cooperate on that level. So it's been a rough marriage, but I think they have patched things up pretty well. And I think we have to view the actions of one as largely the actions of other. And you certainly see that with China's position on Russia's move into Ukraine.
Right. And the BRICS nations agreements and that growing really fast. It's just we have to really, like you said, this is going to be a philosophical choice, but people really, citizens of the United States that actually care about this country and our future and their children and their children's future. And, you know, the old concept of creating a more perfect union as we go really need to decide what they want for America. Because I look at the EU and then I read a lot of Kissinger's work and other work from that time when they created the UN. I see the EU as kind of their first big experiment in dividing the world post nation states. And I really do fear that one of the bigger pictures here of the, you know, I call it, you know, the parent company running planet Earth is to create, like Kissinger wrote in the 70s and 80s, these kind of wards like Hunger Games without nation states that are also controlled by a technocratic technology. They have the technology now. So on the last thing I'm going to ask you is about the full track and trace surveillance on a global scale, because what is happening now, a lot of people know about Elon Musk. There's a new recent deal, but he's one of the biggest contractors, if not the biggest, with the cloud and the satellites and all of that. But China obviously has all of that technology too. And the question is, at what point is the global public-private partnership and the supra group that seems to be above all of our governments at this point cooperating on a global scale to put everyone into kind of the track and trace surveillance model that is normal in China? Because it does seem like there's a bigger picture here. And I'm curious at what level China is running that and is a part of that, because the people here in America have to understand the surveillance state that grew after Patriot Act and continues to grow, I think, is global at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly the intention and the plan. I mean, here's the irony, Mel. When you look back at when the United States started engaging with China and, you know, sending investment dollars there, what was the premise? The premise was, if we embrace them, they're going to become more like us.
Right.
I would argue the exact opposite has happened. We've become more like them.
Right.
In other words, we are starting to embrace some of the Chinese government's models. The social credit system, for example. Are we going to call it the social credit system in the United States? No, that's a little too on brand. But let's figure out other ways in which we can adopt some of those principles. One of Barack Obama's advisors wrote a book called Nudge. about how
yeah.
yeah, government needs to kind of nudge people to go in a certain direction, as if they're, you know, supposed to steer us like a parent rather than than protect us. We're citizens that are allowed to make our own choices. So clearly the mindset is there, and clearly the technological ability is there. The biggest tech firms in America, whether that's Microsoft, whether that is Alphabet or Google, are doing major research projects in China on artificial intelligence with entities that involve the Chinese military and the Chinese surveillance state. And the notion that they are going to take what they learned and not apply it in some way to the United States is laughable. Right. This is what they do. This is their business model. And they are going to convince governments that the way that you can make us safer is by surveilling people longer. I would add to the surveillance component of it, because it's a critical component of it, is the effort to move towards a digital currency. Right. The idea that government should track not only where you're spending money, how much, but what you're spending money on is, again, a function of them wanting to monitor and surveil and know what you are doing. And at the bottom line, what they're telling us is, trust us. We mean this for well, for good intentions. What history teaches us, of course, is if you give a government a tool, to the extent they can do something good with it, they can also do something bad with it. And the chances are overwhelmingly that they're going to choose to do something bad with it.
Yeah, and on top of what you're saying right now, what people should know about is the biometric data capture that is in the World Health Organization paperwork, also through not just what happened at the Wuhan lab, but there's also that BGI that I guess Gates is invested in, where they're collecting DNA samples from people all over the world without people knowing. I mean, this is a Chinese project, but it can't just be Chinese. It has to be expanding. And a lot of these companies, again, when you look at who their biggest shareholders are or their stakeholders, it's the same players. So again, we are still talking about on planet Earth, a rather small group of people that have decided that they will be controlling the world going forward, which then, you know, we are then therefore the majority, but if we don't know it because of our media. So last thing, it's funny you brought up nudge, because I've been telling people don't even know Cass Sunstein is writing these asylum laws. You know, the nudge guy, the minister of truth under Obama is rewriting the laws at the border, too. So people should be aware of that when they're not sure who's running the country. But last thing, what can people do? Because there's a part of me as dystopia as this sounds, I still think that they need our consent and our participation in order to allow this to go forward. And that's on all fronts. So what are your thoughts? And in the book, what do you want people to walk away with on how they can change actually their actions, their life, what they're doing in order to go more towards freedom than towards where this is headed?
No, that's a great question. And look, I would say the biggest concern I have with people that are worried about these issues is people are demoralized, and, yes. and some of them are just giving up. Here's the thing. That's what they want you to do, right? They want you to give up because it makes the job easier going forward. So you can't, I would argue you have to fight to the last breath for these issues, for your sake, for the sake of children and grandchildren and future generations. So there's a couple of things you can do. Is number one is actually let your elected officials, not just your members of Congress and your senators, your local officials. There are things at the local level that can be done that are being done to complicate matters for these efforts, but to also resist them and fight them. But you've got to let your elected officials know you care about these issues, about the sovereignty of the individual, about your privacy, and about protecting you. I was up in DC a couple weeks ago, met with a number of senators and members of Congress, and I'll tell you, a lot of them think that most voters care about taxes and issues like that. They don't care about these fundamental issues about the future course of where we're going as a country. So you've got to let your elected officials know about it. And number two, elections still matter. Again, people get frustrated, okay? This election is rigged, or, you know, this side is censored, or that's happening. All that may or may not be true. The bottom line is you can still control yourself as a sovereign individual. Make sure you vote and make sure you let the people around you know what the issues are. A shocking number of people in America feel like they should vote the week before the election. They will go on Google and type in, who should I vote for? First of all, never trust Google with that.
Oh my, well, at this point, they have their trusted news initiative. The first five pages are basically government controlled media. God forbid you an article by you comes up, let alone Breitbart will never come up. Zero Heads will never come up. Like, it's so ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so there are people around here who earnestly feel like I should vote. They don't know what to do. You know, everybody has friendships, relationships, a community of influence around them. You need to engage with people on this. That is what is going to protect us. You look back at the American founding, basically, most scholars say one third of the people supported independence, one third were pro-British, and one third were kind of indifferent.
Right.
So we've got to go and convince those that are indifferent. I think we kind of have the same divide today on these issues.
Yeah.
One third realize what's are going on and want to deal with it. One third are in favor of what's going on and the direction they want to go. And the other third kind of have their hands up in the air. We need to persuade that other one third to see what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's so important that people locally look into this, because one thing that you do lay out in your book is that some of these lobbying groups, but also NGOs, some of the get out the vote groups, I don't know how involved they are with, obviously, in your other books and also in Seamus Bruner's book. They talk a lot. You talk a lot about some of these giant NGOs, especially like the conglomerates like Arabella and New Venture Fund and all of these. All these little groups are in your local communities under front names. And I think it's also important to look through your book and see some of the Chinese lobbying firms and smaller groups, because they are local as well, and people can find them locally and tell their community members, like, these people aren't really for voter rights or for greener energy. They're actually, you know, manipulating behavior for a different cause. So that's correct. They're everywhere, right?
Yeah, absolutely. At the local level as well. It's not just a battle in Washington, D.C. It's a battle in your community. So you've got to be engaged, and you want to fight for your community and fight for your country.
Okay, great. So tell everyone how they can follow you and find you and follow your work and support you. And I have to tell you, over the last 20 years, I have learned more from you and I've had more faith in you than almost any other journalist or investigator out there. If we had you in there telling people who to investigate and how to get to the bottom of fixing our country, we'd be in a lot better place. So for anyone that doesn't follow you that is watching, it's a must, and especially this book. But I would go back and buy the last five books. And if you can't read them, listen to them, because a lot of us still have hope for justice and for truth and for, you know, God to step in at some point and give us transparency. But if anyone has done the heavy lifting, you have. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you. Tell my audience where you are.
Well, thanks, Mel. You can find me through the Government Accountability Institute, which is a nonprofit organization I head. You can find my website is peterschweitzer.com. You can follow me on Twitter under Peter Schweitzer. And you can find my books everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Costco. Love to hear people's feedback. If you go to the Government Accountability Institute website, we actually have a sheet where if there's something you think we should investigate, you have a unique lead or information you want to share, you can share it. And if we believe we can pursue it, we will. So
that's
thank you
awesome.
For your time.
That's awesome. That gives people power. Go to his website. If you have something, go share it. These people actually care. Thank you so much, Peter. You're amazing. And I look forward to the continued work. It's really incredible. And it is, I believe, helping our country more than almost anything else. Thank you so much, sir.
Great. Thanks, Mel.
Did you know that there are more than 60,000 known chemicals in tap water? And the EPA only tests for 91 of them? This is why we're so grateful that we partnered with Healthy Hydration. They offer whole home water filtration, shower filters, under-the-counter pre-filters, molecular hydrogen water machines, hydrogen water bottles, and so much more for a healthier home and family. So go to themelkshow.com and click on our partners page and check out Healthy Hydration and everything they have in store for your health and wellness today. It's that time of year again. People are getting sick. They're getting the flu. They're getting the cold. They're getting all different kinds of things. And I have always been very grateful for my friendship with Dr. Zelenko, Dr. Z. And though he's not with us anymore and I miss him every day, he has left behind the best remedy to me for anything that ails you. And that is Z-Stack from Dr. Zelenko. There's Z Flu, Z Stack, and Z Kids. There's also many other products there. It's all about naturally boosting your immune health and fighting anything that comes your way. Dr. Zelenko was ahead of his time. He is out there fighting for us still to this day, and he's left behind the best gift. The gift is your health. So go to MelKDrZ.com, or you can go to my partner's page at themelkshow.com, click Dr. Z or Z Stack. Better health for us all awaits. Thank you, Dr. Zelenko. Thank you.